Mr. Chairman, Lords, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's one of those occasions where I can legitimately use that phrase. I'd like to say what a great pleasure it is to be participating in this very important symposium this evening. And though I'm down as representing the Royal Society, I should also say that I'm speaking in a personal capacity, though I'm sure that many of my views will be shared by my colleagues in the leadership team at the Society. Let me just say one or two things about the Royal Society. The Royal Society has an incredible global reach, and it has 15% of its fellowship are Commonwealth Fellows, effectively, and so Australia and India and so on. About 10% of our British fellows, British-born fellows, work overseas, and then another 15% of the fellowship are foreign members. So we have about 40% of the fellowship overseas, and we have an incredible reach, albeit not into China, of course. We have a large number of MOUs with international organisations, including the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And we've recently reviewed our international strategy. And these are the five key themes from the international strategy. I'm not going to talk through most of them, but just theme number three here is to develop stronger links with the emerging economic powers, and in particular, of course, China, India, where we already have very strong links for obvious historical reasons, and Brazil, where our links are not so not so strong as they should be. So China is very much on our agenda. The Society has a very long history of working with China, and official visits by the leadership of the Royal Society began in China in about 1961, and of course reciprocal visits from the Chinese Academy of Sciences. They lapsed for a few years in the 1990s and 2000s, but we have partly arising from our new strategy, we've re-engaged very forcefully with China. And last year, in fact, Sir Paul Nurse, the president, and Julie Maxton, our executive director, who's here, and I went to China for discussions with Chinese leadership, ranging from the Chinese Academy of Sciences to Madame Liu Yangdong. Let me just, probably I'm not the only person who sitting in the room thinking that everybody else knows more about this topic than they do. So let me just say a little bit about myself. Chairman mentioned that I was at Oxford for 17 years on the faculty and 16 years at University of California, and now 7 years in Cambridge, which makes me quite an old fogey, of course. During that time, I've made about 15 visits to China, so it's not a huge number, but in the last decade, my engagement with China's been quite strong. And I was fortunate to chair the first US-China workshop on advanced materials in Beijing in 2005 and took a team of people from all over the USA. It was an incredible meeting. And I was asked by the National Science Foundation of China, the NSFC, to join their International Review Committee in 2010. This was the first international review of the NSFC, and it was a very important event. It was a symbolic event, in a way. And this, just on the right, for a bit of levity, this shows Paul Nurse on the right, me sort of holding the flag in the middle. This is, of course, in the Forbidden City, and Julie Maxton, who not unusually was on crutches. She's a keen jogger, but her eyes are not so good, and so she quite often ends up on crutches for one reason or another. I visited quite a number of places in China, and so I put them on a map just to establish my pedigree. Some of them as a tourist, of course. I've not been professionally to Tibet, but I have been there as a tourist. And I've got very good contacts in CAS, NSFC, and then some of the universities like Peking University, Tsinghua, Fudan down in Shanghai, and Suzhou Institute of Nanotechnology. So I want to be slightly provocative to begin with. And I've listed here some conceptions and misconceptions about science in China. And I'm not going to say which ones I think are misconceptions, but I'm going to discuss most of them. But these are things that quite a lot of people think or suspect, and they affect people's views on whether we should collaborate scientifically with China. One which I heard many, many times is that Chinese scientists excel at execution but are weaker at discovery and innovation. And I want to examine that question, particularly in the context of discovery. People will know, of course, that it's widely believed in companies that intellectual property is not well protected and that Chinese scientists might steal our ideas. That has to be put on the table. Navigating compliance and ethics issues in for companies is quite challenging. And that's more of a kind of cultural issue that requires a sort of deep understanding of how China operates. There have been concerns, most of you will know, about plagiarism and duplication or falsification in Chinese science. And then finally, the sort of view that maybe Chinese universities are not comparable with British ones. So those are things I want to put on the table and discuss them, and without saying at this point which ones I think have any real substance. So I'm going to start off with the question of the discovery science and ask, is discovery science weak in China? And first of all, we have to recognise that the growth of Chinese science is such that the volume of publications from China is second only to the USA now. That's just about the volume. The key thing is, what about the quality of the science? And so what I've done here, and all the data that I collected myself from the Web of Science in the last couple of weeks, and what I'm doing here is comparing publications in science. Science is arguably the world's leading scientific journal. It's published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Every scientist in the audience loves to have papers in science. And these are the publication trends since 2000. Everything goes from 2000 to 2013. The red curve is the UK. The blue curve is China. And you can see that over the last sort of more than a decade, in 2000, there was a factor of 5 difference between the number of scientific publications from the UK and those in China. Now it's 1.5. And you can see that the trend is clear. So the question is, how general is that? I've looked at the world's leading physics journal, which is Physical Review Letters, published by the American Physical Society. Again, there was a factor of 4 back in 2000. It's now sort of less than a factor of 1.5. There's a convergence. You can see that, setting aside issues of numbers of papers, that China is competitive in the world's leading journals. Biotechnology. So I took the data from Nature Biotechnology. This was interesting. In 2000, there were 2 papers in from China and 36 from the UK. Now it's sort of 16 and 25. So again, this is one of the leading life sciences journals in the world. The data are most striking for chemistry, and I was a chemistry professor once upon a time at Oxford, and this is what's happened in the Journal of the American Chemical Society. I think this is arguably the world's top journal in chemistry. And you can see the sort of staggering rise of publications in what we call JACs over the last 14 years compared with the performance of the UK. So there's clear evidence of a sort of convergence between the quality at the top end of Chinese science and British science. Every expectation, of course, that China will overtake us in the near future if it hasn't already done so. And significant differences from field to field. I actually took Britain's leading chemistry journal and chemical communications. I took this one rather than chemical science for the chemists here, because chemical science has only been going for 5 years. And these are kind of staggering results for chemical communications. This is published just up the road on Piccadilly in the Royal Society of Chemistry. It's widely regarded as, you know, one of the top chemistry journals in the world. And there's been, as you can see, an absolute step change. It may be that this is to do with the fact that the RSC opened an office in China a few years ago, and that might be a response to it. But it means that Chinese chemists are producing absolutely world-class work, which you know, is getting into the top journals. And does the work have any impact? I just plotted the citations to the chemical communications data here, and you see the blue curve, the citations to the Chinese data, compared with the citations to the UK-based data shown in red. So what conclusions can we draw from this? One is that China's clearly having a much greater impact in the world's leading scientific journals, unambiguously clear. It's higher in some fields than others. I could put it this way. Chinese science is now in the Premier League in footballing terms, and the future trend is absolutely clear. I think another thing that's very important, we should celebrate the contributions that China's making to the scientific literature, because this is science that a decade or so ago wasn't being done, and there's a large volume of great science being done by China. And so we have to recognise that that's good for the global scientific endeavour, and it's a good thing for mankind as well. And then finally, just sort of postscript, that we can't be complacent if we want to continue to be regarded as a major scientific nation, then there's plenty of competition out there. And we, you know, you can never relax and say that we're in a great spot and so on, because other people are not relaxing. So let me turn to international collaboration. I think this is quite an interesting chart. And in the table on the top left side here shows the number of joint publications from different countries with China. And I saw, because Minister Willett sent his speech to me last week, that he was going to say that we're now number two in joint publications with China. And when I see things coming from government, I don't always believe them. So I went onto the Web of Science myself and did a careful search. And it's absolutely true. Of course, the USA is way ahead of us, as you might imagine. But China, the UK, this is the number of joint publications over the last 14 years, is now ahead of Japan, way ahead of Germany. Australia does well, and Canada, and we're sort of 2.5 times ahead of France. So I'm not quite sure why that is. I don't think anybody really knows why it is, to be honest. It's not completely obvious. This is the trend on the right here. This last year, there were more than 1,000 joint publications between the UK and China. And one of the things you can do on the Web of Science is look at things like acknowledgements to funding agencies. And so I did that, and down in the box here, what you can see is that the NSFC in China was responsible. They were acknowledged over 7,000 times. And CAS, the Chinese Academy of Science, 1.4, and then STFC. I was glad to see the Royal Society did extremely well and was ahead of EPSRC, and then significant contributions from Wellcome, and I ran out of space, but the Leverhulme Trust, and many other organisations, of course. There may be other countries involved in such collaborations. So, nevertheless, most of it's obviously supported by China. And in terms of the publications by field, it's actually dominated by engineering in the broader sense, followed by physics and then chemistry. And then biochemistry and molecular biology is there's probably a factor of 4 difference in the number of joint engineering papers compared with the number of joint life science papers. So there are interesting things here, which I'd be interested if people have views on the origins of these trends. Let me come to the difficult issue of intellectual property. And we all know that there's a perception of an issue about intellectual property. And things have improved a lot, but there's still, nevertheless, circumspection about IP issues, and many companies are concerned about how they can operate confidently in China without having intellectual property compromised. And this, of course, affects our ability to engage totally with China on issues which are close to the marketplace. And there have been a number, say, in the life sciences area, pharmaceutical area, have been a number of recent cases that, you know, give people cause for concern. As an academic, I don't think this is a problem at all, because we talk openly about our results. If people listen to our talks or read our papers and have even better ideas, then that's the way that science works, and so it's not a problem at all. In terms of plagiarism and you know, fraud in scientific publishing, it is a problem everywhere. I think it's probably more of a problem in China than in most places, and I think it's really a consequence of the manner in which the Chinese system rewards scientists for publishing in high-impact papers, publishing large numbers of papers. So there's, you know, there's a connection between where you publish, how much you publish, and your salary at the end of the month, and that you know, can obviously lead to traits which are perhaps unwelcome. And one of the things that happens in China, I know from personal experience, is that with my own co-workers, that impact factors are used very widely for assessing the work of individuals. So instead of reading the papers and saying, is this a good paper, if it's published in a high-impact journal, you get a tick for that. And if you get enough papers in high-impact journals, then you get promoted or you get the grant or whatever. And the Royal Society signed the San Francisco Declaration, which is, you know, speaking against the use of impact factors for the assessment of individuals. So there are, I don't think you can completely sweep the IP issues and other issues under the table. Things are getting better, and in terms of things like plagiarism or multiple copies of the same paper, it's much more difficult to do that now. Because with the, you know, the power of big data, a lot of the journals screen your paper. When you submit it, they'll screen the electronic version of it and try and match it against other publications, because there are huge databases. So a bit like, you know, with examinations now, that it's possible to do that. So if this is a problem, then it's a problem that's going to be short-lived, because technology will resolve it. Now, what about the quality of the research in Chinese universities? This is an interesting question. And I think you have to recognize that a large proportion of the best science in China is carried out in the institutes of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And there are about 100 of them. And they're separate from the universities. And they have no counterparts in Britain. So comparing British universities, where we have no major institutes except a handful in the life sciences, is a meaningless comparison. And it's China's more like Germany, where the Max Planck Society dominates research in many respects with its large network of high-powered centres. Notwithstanding that, there are a number of universities that are strong at research, such as Peking University, Tsinghua, Fudan, the CAS University of Science and Technology. And of course, lots of British universities have voted with their feet by having exchange programs with them. And we're in a very strong position because English is our native language, and so there's a great preference for having native English speaking collaborators or even faculty. So some of you might be familiar with the Leiden ranking of universities. There are lots of ranking of universities, and universities pick the ones that place them highest, of course. And many of them, you know, they include issues like what do employers think, what do the alumni think, how much funding comes in, and so on. The Leiden ranking simply looks at research output and ranks based upon citations per paper. So it's normalised per paper for different institutions. It's also normalised for differences between different fields. So life sciences papers are cited much more than chemistry, which is more than physics, which is more than engineering, for example. So it's weighted for that. So how does China do in the latest ranking? The top Chinese university was Fudan at number 96 in physical sciences, this is. That may sound, you know, not so good. Actually, there are no British universities in the top 20. You know, Oxford and Cambridge are in the kind of low 20s. And Fudan was slightly ahead of Edinburgh and Durham, which were 107 and 108. So that puts this into context. Tsinghua University was 142, and that was just behind Sheffield and Bath. On the other hand, if you look at the very top in physical sciences, the top Indian university was the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore, which was 288. And we would never talk about the Institute of Science as being, you know, not a premier research institution. In the life sciences, China's, I think, weaker. So the top university in life sciences ranking was Tsinghua in 208. So as with all the journals data, there's some evidence that China's much stronger in some fields than others. So a couple of questions now. Is Britain well placed to respond to the growth in Chinese science? And the first point I want to make is a massive mismatch between the number of Chinese students studying here and the number of Brits who are studying in China. And so in 2012, about 46,000 Chinese students arrived in the UK to study here. So at any given time, there are maybe 135,000, 140,000 Chinese students here, whereas the number in going to China in the same year was about 4,000. And I don't have a precise number. What I do know is that the number from the UK was not in the top 15, so it's not even listed. And it's behind Singapore, which is listed, and is well behind France, which was 8,400, and Germany, which was 6,300. And the mismatch, this doesn't include all the people who come here for postdocs, and so the mismatch is even greater at the postdoctoral level. And I think that's partly, sorry about the typo, that visa issues are problematic at the postdoctoral level, and so people, you know, the first choice is to go to the USA. But I think the key thing going forward is that we really need to educate a workforce that's well informed about the strengths and weaknesses of China and familiar with Chinese culture. And only then can we really truly make the best of working with our Chinese colleagues. So final comments. Academic collaboration, to my mind, with China is highly desirable because China's developed into one of the leading scientific nations in the world. And that, you know, from the Royal Society's point of view, that clearly is a top priority, and we want to engage with them. There's already a great deal of collaboration between the UK and China, most of it supported by the NSFC or CAS, but that's going to improve as well, of course, with this new Newton Fund that the chairman mentioned. This third point, I think, is the most important message. That our greatest need, to my mind, is providing more young British scientists with the opportunity to experience China, to get people over there. And it may be that there are the opportunities and people don't feel inclined to do it. I think if they saw the talk I just given, then they might think, well, maybe there's a future there. But another sort of more general point is that in addition to producing good research, don't underestimate the soft power of scientific engagement. And that's historically been very important with our engagement with Russia, with South Africa, even Argentina, and also with China. And then finally, this is not something that can be done, you know, by email and so on. That face-to-face interactions are extremely important when dealing with China. So you do need to get feet on the ground and spend time there in order to get the best out of it. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for your kind attention. Thank you.